All right, welcome everyone. It is 10:01. It is Sunday, June the 2nd, 2013, and we are gathered here together to learn about Theseus, one of the biographies in Plutarch's lives. As you all know, because I say it every time we come here, but I want you all to remember it, Plutarch was born in 45 AD, and he died about 120 AD. He was born in Chaeronea, which is northwest of Athens. He was a very famous man in his own time. He was wealthy. He was one of the priests of Apollo at Delphi. He was probably a Roman citizen, but he obviously was a Greek and wrote in Greek and lived in Greece. And he was, as I said, famous in his own time. He was fortunate enough to live the last part of his life during the period of the five great emperors. The five great emperors are Fabius Maximus, who served for 2 years. Nerva, who served for 2 years from 96 to 98. And then Trajan, who was emperor for 19 years. Then Hadrian for 21 years. Antoninus Pius for 23 years. And finally, the last of the five great emperors was Marcus Aurelius. So, during most of his life, from the age of 45 until he died 40 years later, or some years later, he was living under one of the great Roman emperors, which meant peace, prosperity, and wealth. And so he was the beneficiary of that, and he was allowed to write his works. The work we are studying is Plutarch's lives, the parallel lives of Greeks and Romans, and there are, I believe, 46 of those lives. He wrote 23 lives in parallel, and we have done already Pericles and Fabius Maximus, Coriolanus and Alcibiades, Lycurgus and Numa. Now we are going to start the pair, which is Theseus and Romulus. Now, what I'd like to communicate to you before I get into Plutarch's Theseus is what I perceive to be the point of all this. Now, I have the pleasure and the honor of giving oratory today, and during oratory, I'm going to tell a story about my experience with the French language. And that story is roughly that I've been working on French since I was in high school, since I was 16, 17, or 18. I have been taking French or interested in French in various forms, but it was always a secondary activity or much lower priority for me. This year, I finally caught a glimpse of the forest for the trees, let us say. And what I mean by that is that I've always studied vocabulary words, French words, the rules of French grammar. I've studied declination of nouns and pronouns. I've studied conjugation of verbs and, all of the details, all the little details, the trees of the French language. But this year, we read a book in my French class, and I finally caught a glimpse of what I think is the forest. And the reason I tell that story is this, that I am arguing that the forest that we're interested in, the Fellowship of Reason, is the forest which is ethics, generally speaking, morality and ethics. And in order to become aware of the forest of ethics, the big picture of ethics, we have to look at a lot of trees. And what Plutarch's lives are the trees. They are among the trees of the moral forest. And that is why we are studying Plutarch's lives. That is why we study many, many things, but this is one of the trees, or among the, one group of the trees that we're studying. And so that is our purpose. We are trying to get a picture. We're trying to learn all the trees so that at some point in our lives, we will get the big moral picture. Now, another thing about my story with respect to French is this. I just got a glimpse of the forest, even though I've been working on French, various degrees of intensity for 45 years. What does that say about ethics? That says that ethics, too, in order to perceive the forest, which is ethics and morality, that we're not going to necessarily get it in a week or a month or a year or maybe 45 years. So what I'm trying to say is that this is a continuing process for me in French, and it's a continuing process for us all in coming to grips with the idea of what the big moral picture is. And it is such a pleasure to have gotten a glimpse of the French language, and it's such a pleasure for me to look at these trees, and one of those trees is Theseus. So let's go into the text of Plutarch's conversation about Theseus. Now, in the very first thing that Plutarch says in his work, his essay on Theseus, is something that was interesting to me, particularly because it's exactly how I came to Theseus. Plutarch says that, you know, I wrote the lives of Numa. I was writing the life of Numa and contrasting that with Lycurgus, and I said, well, what should I do now? And he said, well, we looked at Numa, and Numa was a king that came after Romulus, and so I'm kind of interested in Romulus, and why don't I write about it? And that was exactly how, not to make any comparisons necessarily between me and Plutarch, but I read Numa, studied Numa, and enjoyed Numa, and I said, well, let's look at Romulus. But before you can look at Romulus in the parallel lives, you have to look at Theseus. And so Romulus leads to Theseus, and Plutarch actually talks about his trouble, because he really wants to talk about Romulus, which we're not going to talk about today. And he says, well, who do I contrast with Romulus? And Plutarch says, well, I think Theseus is the man. And he said, for a variety of reasons, because and among the reasons he gives are they're both of sort of mythological origin. They both come from uncertain parentage. They both are charged with the rape of women, which probably means the carrying off women. You will remember that Romulus is accused of the rape of the Sabines. We talked about that last time. Anyway, so Plutarch saw these parallels between Theseus and Romulus, and so he said, well, that's the parallel life, that's who I'm going to parallel my talk on Romulus with, and hopefully we'll do that in July, we'll do Romulus. So what does Plutarch say about Theseus? He tells us that he is the child of a king whose name was Aegeus, A-E-G-E-U-S, and as I will tell you shortly, Aegeus is for whom the Aegean Sea is named, which is the sea east of Greece. And Aegeus went to the gods and asked a question, and the gods told him that he could not have relations with women, and there was some ambiguity in him. There was the idea that maybe it was just Athenian women, and so he went to a neighboring town, and there was a famous man in that neighboring town whose name was Pythias. And Pythias was famous because he had many, many children. And what he did with those children is that he would pair them up with all kinds of kings and good people and great people all about him in order to make his relationship stronger. I mean, this is very common even in the Middle Ages when you marry your daughter off to kings. And so he, by trickery or otherwise, got Aegeus to have intercourse with his daughter Aethra, who's pictured there in one of those pictures. And she became pregnant by Theseus, and Theseus wanted to go back to Athens, but he's leaving his daughter behind. And so he leaves a sword and some sandals behind, and he puts them in a great rock monument with holes cut out that exactly fit the sword and exactly fit the sandals, puts the top on the rock monument and tells Aethra that, you know, if I have a son and when he comes to age, I want you to tell him about this rock that has the sword and the stone and my sandals, and I want you to take him to it, and if he's strong enough, he will be able to. Where's that picture? That's his picture right here, where his mother is taking Theseus to this place where the sword and the sandals are, and says, "Take him there and send him my way, and I'll know him by these signs." And of course, we all recognize this story. I don't know if it's the root of the sword and the stone, but you know, we see that all the time. Well, not all the time, but frequently in modern mythology or later mythology or later stories about the you know, the son who, the secret, the man with power who gets the sword and the stone. So, Pythias put out the story that, because there was, I don't know why Pythias would do this, but he said that his daughter had had sex with Poseidon, and therefore this child, Theseus, was the child of Poseidon. So there's some ambiguity as to the alleged parenthood of Theseus, whether it's actually Aegeus, named for the Aegeans, or whose name becomes the Aegean Sea, and Aethra, or Theseus. So Theseus might have divine origins, at least that's part of the mythology. So Theseus decides that he's going to go back to Athens and claim his heritage. And of course, part of the point here is that Athens doesn't exist at the time. He's going back to that area. And so he sets out with good intentions, and quoting from Plutarch, he says, with this mind and these thoughts, he set forward with a design to do injury to nobody, but to repel and revenge himself of all those who should offer any injury. He was advised to go by sea because it's safe. If you go by land, you have the problem of facing various bad guys. But he decides that, you know, I'm a hero, and so I have to go the hard way, and I have to therefore go by land and cross these various heroes. Now, in this accounting that Plutarch gives us, there are six encounters that he has. And it's kind of it's a peculiar structure, and one of the things that's suggested, because later we're going to hear about Hercules and Theseus being related to Hercules in some way or being his friend, one of the things that comes to mind is that this is sort of an emulation of the trials of Hercules, that he has to, like Hercules, Theseus has to go through various trials on his way back to Athens. So let me tell you briefly about these little trials, these six encounters that he has on his way back to Athens. His first contact is with a monster called Periphetes. And Periphetes is called the club bearer. He has a large bronze club. And what he does is, when travelers come by, he just knocks them dead. So he's a bad guy. He, it is said, was the son of Hephaestus, who was the crippled god of the smithy. He was a crippled god, but obviously of divine origin. And so Theseus meets up with this guy. He says, well, I'm not sure that's bronze, so let me look at your club and make sure it's a bronze club. The guy says, okay, take a look. And then he takes the club and whacks the guy over the head, killing him, and then Theseus takes the club as his own. His next encounter was with a person who was in the isthmus of the Peloponnesus, and I'm assuming that this is that small strip of land that connects the Peloponnesus, which is the sort of big part in the southwest of Greece, which contains Sparta, and then there's a small isthmus which connects over to the bigger part of Greece, which contains Athens. So he's crossing at that point, I think, and he has a character there named Simonides, who is called the Bender of Pines, and of course he is bad for travelers too, and what his particular thing is that he'll catch a traveler, he will bend pines down, tie the traveler to the pines, let the pines go, and it rips the person apart. So one of the characteristics and one of the things that Plutarch says about Theseus in all these battles is that Theseus wants to kill all of these bad people using the same techniques by which they kill others. And so Plutarch says that Theseus had no training in bending of pines and in tearing people apart with pines, but he slew Sinis by bending pines. Now, Sinis had a daughter whose name was Perigune, P-E-R-I-G-U-N-E, and she was a beautiful woman, a beautiful child, or a young woman. And so Theseus, who we will see here shortly, is interested in women, and so he chases after her, and she goes hides in bushes, and she's apparently not very bright, and she prays to the, she's hiding among asparagus, for other, among other things, and she prays to the asparagus to protect her from Theseus, but Theseus finds her and says, look, I will use you with respect, is the literal, is how the translation comes across. And so Theseus does have sex with her and ultimately has a child by her. But the more interesting thing about all of that, it seems to me, is the fact that Perigune, this girl, this gorgeous girl, who's the child of this the bender of pines, actually appears again in Shakespeare. She appears as Perigina in Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream. Now, I'm not familiar enough with Midsummer Night's Dream to call that character to mind, but I can assure you that the next time I come across the Midsummer Night's Dream and I see Perigina, I will try to make some connection with her. All right, his third encounter was with the Chromion sow, which was apparently an animal, a beast, a dangerous beast. And one of the things Plutarch says is that Theseus didn't actually run across this guy on his way to this character, this beast on the way to Athens, but that he went out of his way, and the reason he went out of his way to find it was so that his battles were not merely of necessity. In other words, he actually went out and sought out this particular this enemy, and he saw it and sought to slay it. This particular mythological being, according to one of the sources I've read, actually appears in Percy Jackson's the last episode of the Percy Jackson, and Percy Jackson apparently has an encounter with the Clazmonian sow, who is suggested to be this very character. Okay, then the next person he comes across with was the king of Eleusia, who is a very strong man, and this is another godlike character. This character is the son of Poseidon too. I mean, Theseus is alleged to be the son of Poseidon, and the way this particular king kills the passersby is being very strong. He undertakes to wrestle them, and he wrestles them to death. Well, naturally enough, Theseus engages in wrestling, and Theseus wins and kills this king. And the secondary source says that thus Theseus invented wrestling. And of course, we all are aware, we have a sense, I think, that wrestling was a big deal in Athens, and so they're attributing to Theseus, by telling this story, his invention of that particular activity. The next person he met was also a son of Poseidon, allegedly Procrustes. And the way Procrustes would kill people was that he had two beds. And when someone who was 6 feet tall came in there, he would put him on the 6 foot tall bed, his feet would be hanging over, and he'd cut his feet off. And if somebody was too short, he'd put him in a too long bed, and he would behead them or something. And so he was a really mean guy. And this particular character comes down to us in the phrase of a Procrustean bed. Now, I've not heard of this myself, but what a Procrustean bed is an incommensurate measure. So obviously, if someone's measuring this by that, and somehow it's not an appropriate measure, it's referred to as a Procrustean bed. So this mythological story comes down to us in the form of a reference, which we might hear. So if we ever in the future run across a criticism of a measurement which is Procrustean, we say, oh, I know what he's talking about. He's talking about Procrustes, who had, you know, put the person in the wrong size bed and killed him as a consequence. So that is that. And thus Theseus arrives in Athens, having had great adventures. And when he arrives there, the place is in disarray. Everybody is, they're not organized. They're having a tough time. And the wife of Aegeus at this time is Medea. And I'm not going to tell the story of Medea, nor may I get it right, but no matter what I say, it's probably going to be close, because there were so many different versions of Medea. But one of the famous things about Medea was that she was the wife of Jason and the Argonauts, and that she, to get even with Jason, killed their children. And so there's some images, Renaissance images of Medea, you know, with a knife hanging over her two own children, punishing her husband by killing his children, her own children. But anyway, so she is the wife of Aegeus at this time. She recognizes him and is threatened by him because, you know, she is among the factions that are rivaling for power in Athens. And so she conspires to kill him and persuades Aegeus to kill him. And they have poison in a cup. And at the banquet, Theseus is there with the poison, and he pulls his sword out and is going to cut the meat up in order to eat it. And Dad, Aegeus, recognizes the sword and said, "Behold, it's my son Theseus." You know, knocks the cup out of his hand, it burns a hole of acid in the ground, and Theseus is recognized as the first son, the rightful heir to Aegeus. War breaks out because we have this new contender, and Theseus and his dad bring everything under control, and they bring the city to heel, and he is accepted. He then goes on a couple of adventures. He's sent off to Marathon to defeat a bull, and then he has the adventure which we are most familiar with, that is the adventure of the Minotaur. Now, so it's Theseus and Ariadne. Is it Ariadne? Who are the main characters of this story? And what had happened was the Minos, the king of Crete, had sent his son to Athens to participate in games, and his son was greatly popular and was winning big games. And one group who were jealous of this son of the king of Crete had him assassinated. The king of Crete naturally was quite irritated and sent a force to Athens to destroy it and demand of King Aegeus that they give up the assassins. King Aegeus doesn't know who the assassins are, and so what he does is he says, "Okay, rather than giving you up the assassins, we promise to give you the tribute of 7 young men and 7 young women every 7 years as sort of a penalty for having killed your son." And so this has been going on at this time for about 3 cycles. And when we find ourselves with Theseus there, and they're on the 3rd cycle. Now, before I continue with the story, which we probably all know anyway, one of the most interesting facts that I discovered in preparing for this is that it is this story which is the basis of the Hunger Games. I mean, the author of the Hunger Games specifically claims that she was basing her story on the Hunger Games. Now, some of you may have seen it, all of you may have seen it, but the Hunger Games is a story. There's 12 districts in this mythological place, and every one of those districts has to offer up one of their children to the... Two of their children? It is 2? Okay, even works better. I was trying to figure that out. So they have to offer up 2 of their children to the games. The children, so there will be 24 children, have to go to the games, and then only one survives. Katniss Everdeen and her male companion end up surviving in a violation of the rules, it turns out. But the lady who wrote that book says, "I did this based upon the Minotaur story," which really enhances the whole experience for me greatly. So anyway, Theseus goes to the island of Crete, to Minos. He volunteers. He says, "You know, I'm going to suffer with my people too, so I'm going to be among the 7 virgins and 4 young men who are going to go to Crete with the idea that I'm going to kill the Minotaur." And he tells his dad, "If I am successful, when we sail back, we'll sail back with a white sail." They sail out with a black sail because it's a sad thing. And the routine is you sail coming hither and on with the black sail. But he says, "If I come back successfully, I will have a white sail. You will see it, and you can celebrate before I arrive." So he gets there, and Ariadne, who I have pictured here in a reclining pose, immediately falls in love with Theseus and wants to help him. So she gives him the famous ball of string. You know, he ties it to the door of the labyrinth. He goes in and ends up killing the Minotaur and following the ball of string out. He takes Ariadne with him. Plutarch describes of several outcomes for Ariadne, none of them good. One of the stories he tells is that she was massively pregnant. She got seasick. He put her on an island, went back to the ship to manage it during a storm. She dies in pregnancy, but he gives money to the people to continue offering, making offerings to her every year. Ariadne doesn't do well, it turns out, in some of these stories. Ariadne appears in modern movies as well. Ariadne is the name of a character in the movie Inception. Did anybody see Inception? It's a movie about somehow going inside the mind and layers upon layers of complexity of the mind and sort of a labyrinth of the mind, and they take her, the character Ariadne, and put her in that play too, in that movie too. And I just love it when I see those connections, see it like that. So anyway, he's successful. He's defeated the bull. He comes back to Athens, but unfortunately he forgets to put up the white sail. And so as he approaches, his dad, Aegeus, sees the black sail, thinks his son has been killed, and decides to jump off a cliff into the ocean and dies. And they name the ocean after him, Aegean Sea. So that's the origin of the Aegean Sea. So we found out the source of wrestling and the source of the Aegean Sea so far, and there we go. All right, so he's back from Crete. His dad, Aegeus, is dead. They've named the Aegean Sea. And so now he is the king. And this is sort of the culmination of all of this, that now he can found the city of Athens. And so his idea is that we need to all come together, and he's all by this time very famous because he's done the six labors of Hercules, not Hercules, and he's done this great deed to save the virgins and the young men from the Minotaur. And so he's very famous, and he decides to found Athens. I want to skip back with one point, and that is the ship he came back in. This ship from Crete was highly revered at the time. And, you know, so they saved the physical ship. And what they did, because ships rot, they're made out of wood, is that they would replace the wood. The oars, when they rotted, or when this plank rotted, they replaced this and that. And so after a while, obviously, the entire ship is replaced by new wood. And so this fact raises the philosophical question, and apparently it's referred to, is it the same ship, right? And of course we have that same question is asked of, I don't know where we heard this, in the human body, where the human body is, every cell is ultimately replaced during your lifetime, and are you the same person even though your entire body has been placed by process of various processes. But I thought that this ship example, which is sort of an origin for that question, and the question is constantly asked, was something interesting. So we're back to the founding of Athens. Theseus is going to found Athens. He says that to the people, he says, look, you know, I'm not interested in forming a kingship. I'm going to be the leader, and I'm going to be the king until we found it, but we will have a commonwealth, we will have a democracy, and it will be a people's government. And he did, after he established the city, he laid down his regal power and established a commonwealth. The Plutarch says that Homer, when writing about, and this is sort of contemporaneous, this period of time is contemporaneous with the Trojan War, within years of it, that the Homer mentions, when there's the list of ships, there's a famous passage in the Iliad, which has a list of ships, and he refers to the Athens ship only as the people's ship, and this is a reference to the fact that Athens is a democracy, a commonwealth, and so Theseus is credited with that aspect of the creation of the state of Athens, of this commonwealth thing. He divided people into three groups, the noblemen, the husbandmen, and handcrafters. This is of some interest to those of us who, that would be all of us who are interested in this tripartite structure, which is a common mythological structure. Plato has it too. He talks about the gold people, the bronze people, and the people of iron, or go. And so this division of people into classes, which are generally the one other division would be the spiritual people, and then the warriors, and then the common people. But this tripartite division is a very common Indo-European division of cultures, and so they're giving him credit for making this division. They give Theseus credit for having done the marking of boundaries. For example, they say specifically that at the isthmus, which divides the Peloponnesus from the main part of Greece, that he put up a famous pillar in which he said, Peloponnesus this way and Ionia this way. Gives him credit for that. He did. He coined money with the image of an ox, and so he was a great founder of Rome. The end of his life is not quite as glorious, arguably. He has an encounter with the Amazons. He does or does not have a relationship with the Amazons, but whatever that contact with the Amazons was induced the Amazons to have war with Athens, and they did have such a war. He decided that he wanted to have... He wanted to marry the child of a goddess. And so he meets up with a friend whose name is Perithos. And the way they meant was Perithos had heard in the vicinity of Marathon, heard that Theseus was a great man and he wanted to test him. So this guy Perithos goes and steals Theseus's cattle. And of course Theseus is unhappy with that and he mounts a force to go attack him. But Perithos doesn't run. He turns and comes to face him, and they, seeing each other across a great battlefield, they instantly fall in love with one another because they're both glorious men, and they become fast friends. So these two fast friends decide that they are entitled to marry goddesses or the children of gods, and so they decide to go steal Helen. This is Helen of Troy. And so they go to Sparta and they kidnap, the word in the text is rape, but she was too young to have to be married at the time, so I presume she's too young to rape in the sense that we would use rape. And so they steal her off, and they flip a coin and it turns out that Theseus gets Helen, and the other gentleman, whose name I'm not pronouncing right, Perithos, they have to get a girl for him. And so they decide to go to the underworld and they want to get Proserpine, of all people, the wife of the king of Hades, although that's not exactly what they say here in the text, although the other texts actually say that. But they do name the girl he's after as Proserpine, and they do talk about the dog, which ends up killing this other guy, Perithios, is Cerberus. And so, the names match the allegation I'm making right now that they're going to Hades to get the wife of Hades. So that doesn't work out well. Theseus is held captive. The other guy ends up being killed in that particular adventure, and he's there for a while. Hercules learns of Theseus's difficulty and decides that he will go down there and ask that his friend Theseus be released. He is successful in that request. And Theseus comes back to Athens, where the city has fallen into faction and great disputes, and it's a miserable mess. And so Theseus decides, I'm going to send my children away to another place, and I myself am going to go into exile. And the place that he goes, he's not well treated, and he ends up being ignobly pushed off a cliff and killed. So Theseus doesn't end well, but... He had a great legacy, which was Athens. So this is the life of Theseus, as told by our hero, our author Plutarch. And I don't know what we can learn from that, but I enjoyed reading it. That's what all I have to say. But I'd love to hear any comments or questions that you might have about this subject.
I have several comments. First, thank you for continuing. I appreciate hearing all of this. And I loved your comments on the forest and the trees at the beginning, because I think that's a lot of what we are in the Fellowship of Reason, studying trees and with
So it is Theseus' boat. I mean, I could have misread it, because it does talk about Jason and the Argonauts in here, too, so I could have misread it. But yeah, apparently it is.
And as being 6'4", I have slept in my share of procrustes.
Yeah, had anybody ever heard of that reference before? You had? I had not never heard that before, so that was something new. I always learned, love to learn something new. Yeah, this was a little harder in terms of analysis to me, but at some point, you know, I could see the forest for the trees, because I was looking at all these trees and I'm saying, what is this story after story? You know, why are we telling these six stories? What do they have to do with anything? And then suddenly he's, oh, I see. They're building Athens. They're building Athens traditions. They're imitating Hercules. They're, you know, all of these things come. Oh, I get it now. It was also very interesting to me to read the story of the Minotaur. And these are very simple and unelaborate, right? I mean, the story is told here of Theseus and Ariadne and the Minotaur. It's a very structured. It's like when I try to describe what happened in the Hunger Games. You know, it's just very little structure. But that was a 2.5-hour movie. And so it tells me something about storytelling, that once you get the story, and all of these things are very simple little stories, like, you know, the Bender of Pines is a paragraph long, or some of them are even just a sentence or two, and yet, based upon that single idea, an author can then, like the author of The Hunger Games, making a whole elaborate story, because she says, okay, let's learn about these seven virgins and seven warriors, and let's feel with them, and of course the reader doesn't know what's going to happen to them, and so it creates this tension. And so it tells me something about storytelling, because the story once told in a short version isn't really very interesting. It's the elaboration of the details and the tension created by not knowing the outcome because you haven't heard the structure, which makes the story interesting. Plus, also the unusualness of the structure. I mean, the fact that you're in a maze, the fact that you have a half man, half bull, and all of these things are things that you don't expect and are not aware of. And so that as you unfold that, that's what's interesting in storytelling. Happens, yes, sir.
Going back to the stories of his journey toward Athens, obviously he needed a PR plaque to make sure that these stories were distributed. Is there any clue of that hero?
No, I don't know that. I don't know that tale. Of course, Plutarch is our PR flag, and he transmitted that all to us very effectively. And people use it even today. I think it's just marvelous. All right. Well, thank you. And then we will take a short recess, and we will resume with the big show at 11 o'clock. Thank you very much.